Hey, I'm Chris.
What's up? I'm Mars.
And you're listening to Surgery Shelf Prep. All right, team. Today, we're diving into a super high-yield topic for your shelf exam, and definitely in real life, initial evaluation and management of trauma. We're going to distill the core Advanced Trauma Life Support, or ATLS, principles for you. These are the gold standards, no cap.
For real, the whole point of ATLS is to give clinicians a systematic approach to trauma care to prevent missed injuries and to ensure we prioritize treating the greatest threat to life first. We need to be able to act over diagnosis, meaning you start treatment without waiting for that definitive diagnosis to roll in. Think of it as damage control, but for people.
Exactly. And we can't forget the golden hour, that critical window where early intervention can drastically improve survival. It's not necessarily a fixed 60 minutes, but it emphasizes urgency to positively impact morbidity and mortality. Teamwork is also super crucial here. Trauma management is always a collaborative effort.
Big facts, and that's where the common language of ATLS comes in. It provides a shared framework so everyone on the team is on the same page from the moment EMS rolls up to definitive care.
So, let's break down the primary survey, which is your rapid initial assessment with simultaneous resuscitation. We're talking the ABCDEs of trauma care, baby.
First up, A, airway with C-spine protection.
Why is C-spine protection so important, Mars?
Because, my friend, you gotta assume cervical spine injury in all trauma patients until it's cleared. When you're securing that airway, use a jaw thrust maneuver. It's preferred over the chin lifts if a C-spine injury is suspected because it avoids extending the patient's neck.
What's a quick way to assess the airway, Mars?
The 10-second airway assessment. Just speak to the patient. If they give you an appropriate response, it suggests their airway's patent, and they can generate air movement to permit speech. Failure to respond means urgent assessment and management are needed.
Now, when do we go for the big guns, the definitive airway, which usually means an endotracheal tube or ETT?
You're thinking GCS less than 8, the classic mantra, less than 8, intubate. Also, if you've got significant facial trauma, burns with airway edema, or massive blood in the airway, it's time to intubate to protect that airway.
Any contraindications for that nasotracheal route?
Absolutely. Suspected basal skull fracture, particularly involvement of the cribriform plate, means no nasal tracheal intubation because you could end up in the cranial vault. That's a major shelf pearl.
So what if intubation fails or is contraindicated? We need a surgical airway, right?
You got it. For adults with failed airway attempts, a cricothyroidotomy is the way to go. It's quicker and has less bleeding than a tracheostomy in emergencies. But listen up, medical students. For children younger than 12 years old, we opt for a needle cricothyroidotomy instead.
And a final pearl for the airway section, especially for our burn patients.
Self-pearl. For burn patients to singe nasal hairs, carbonaceous sputum, or hoarseness, think early intubation. Airway edema can worsen rapidly, so you want to secure that airway before it becomes impossible. Don't delay.
Moving on to B, breathing and ventilation. Airway patency isn't enough. You need adequate gas exchange. What are the big life-threatening thoracic injuries we're looking for here?
The usual suspects, tension pneumothorax, open pneumothorax, flail chest, and massive hemothorax.
Break down tension pneumothorax for us.
Okay, so air gets into the pleural space but can't get out. This causes a rapid buildup of pressure, lung collapse, and a mediastinal shift to the opposite side, which then impairs venous return to the heart, leading to a drop in cardiac output and shock. On exam, you'll see acute respiratory distress, subcutaneous emphysema, absent unilateral breath sounds, hyperresonance to percussion, and tracheal shift away from the injured side.
And the immediate fix?
Don't wait for x-ray confirmation. You go straight for immediate thoracic decompression with a needle decompression in the second intercostal space at the mid-clavicular line, then follow up with a chest tube placement.
How about an open pneumothorax, also known as a sucking chest wound?
This is a direct opening in the chest wall, allowing air to move freely in and out of the pleural space. Think of it like a gaping wound. The key is to immediately cover it with an occlusive dressing secured on three sides. This creates a flutter valve effect, letting air out but not in. Then you need a chest tube placed through intact skin elsewhere.
Flail chest. What's the deal there?
This is when you have fractures of three or more adjacent ribs in two or more places, creating a segment of the chest wall that moves independently or paradoxically with breathing. It's a big deal because it often comes with a pulmonary contusion, which is a bruising of the lung. The main treatment is pain control and positive pressure ventilation.
Last but not least for breathing, massive hemothorax.
This is where you have more than 1,500 milliliters of blood in the chest cavity. Signs include shock, decreased or absent breath sounds, and dullness to percussion on the affected side. The management is immediate chest tube insertion, a large one, followed by blood transfusion and potentially operative intervention if bleeding continues rapidly.
All right, moving swiftly to C, circulation with hemorrhage control, what's the golden rule for shock in trauma?
Shock in trauma equals hemorrhage until proven otherwise, period. You always assume bleeding until you confirm another cause.
So, where are the 5 main sources of bleeding that can lead to shock?
Think big cavities or big bones, chest, abdomen, pelvis, or retroperitoneum, long bones like femurs, and obviously external wounds.
So, how do we get fluids in fast? Vascular access is key.
You need 2 large bore IVs, 14 to 16 gauge. If you can't get IV access quickly, go for intraosseous IO access. That's right into the bone marrow, and it works fast in all age groups.
What kind of fluids are we starting with?
Always warmed crystalloids, typically lactated ringers, LR. And if your patient is really crashing, bleeding a lot, you need to activate the massive transfusion protocol, or MTP. That means giving lots of packed red blood cells, PRBCs, plasma, and platelets in a balanced ratio.
MTP is there to prevent what we call the lethal triad. What is that, Mars?
The lethal triad is hypothermia, coagulopathy, and acidosis. These 3 together make bleeding worse and greatly increase mortality, so you must prevent and correct them aggressively.
We also hear about permissive hypotension. What's that about?
In penetrating trauma without a head injury, you might target a systolic blood pressure, SBP, of around 90 until you achieve hemorrhage control. This is done to avoid dislodging clots and worsening bleeding before surgery.
And for pelvic fractures, what's the move?
Apply a pelvic binder immediately in unstable patients with suspected pelvic fracture to help reduce blood loss from the retroperitoneum.
Shelf Pearl time for pulses.
Remember these because they're frequently tested. If you can feel a radial pulse, your SBP is at least 80. If you feel a femoral pulse, it's 70. And if you only feel a carotid pulse, your SBP is 60. It's a quick bedside hemodynamic check.
Moving on to D, disability, which is your neurologic assessment. What's the go-to tool for level of consciousness?
The Glasgow Coma Scale, or GCS. A GCS of 15 means fully alert, while 8 or less means intubate. It's made up of I, V, and M responses, E plus V plus M.
What about pupillary exam findings?
If you see unequal pupils combined with head trauma, that's a red flag for uncal herniation. Immediate treatment includes giving mannitol or hypertonic saline to reduce intracranial pressure and prepare for emergent decompression. You may also raise the head of the bed, provide adequate analgesia and sedation, and hyperventilate the patient for a temporary treatment.
Is hypotension ever caused by head injury alone?
Nope, not typically. Hypotension is generally not caused by head injury alone, except in terminal stages of brain injury or if there's a concurrent spinal cord injury causing neurogenic shock. But remember, increased intracranial pressure can cause the Cushing triad, hypertension, bradycardia, and irregular respirations called Shane-Stokes pattern.
Last but not least, E, exposure and environmental control.
You gotta fully expose the patient to assess for all injuries, cut off those clothes, but then critically, rewarm them immediately to prevent hypothermia.
Why is avoiding hypothermia so important, Mars?
Because hypothermia worsens coagulopathy. Remember that lethal triad? Hypothermia is a core component, making it harder for blood to clot and causing more bleeding.
All right. Once the primary survey is done and resuscitation is underway, what's next, Mars?
That's when you roll into the secondary survey. This is a more detailed head-to-toe evaluation, and it begins only after the primary survey is completed and the patient is stabilized.
What history do we need to get here?
The ample history is your mnemonic: allergies, medications, past illnesses, pregnancy, last meal, and events of the injury. You also perform a full head-to-toe physical exam, and don't forget to roll log the patient to check their back. It's often missed.
And what about monitoring?
You need to reassess vitals frequently throughout this process because a patient's condition can change rapidly.
All right, let's talk about some specific high-yield injury squad. First, what if you see mediastinal widening on a chest X-ray?
Think blunt aortic injury. That widened mediastinum is a classic sign.
What about for splenic injury? Is there a classic sign?
Yep, Kerr sign. That's left shoulder pain radiating from irritation of the diaphragm, highly suggestive of a splenic injury.
What's the big risk with long bone fractures?
Fat embolism. Be on the lookout for a triad of petechy, hypoxia, and confusion.
And for cardiac tamponade?
That's Beck's triad. Hypotension, JVD, and muffled heart sounds. Super important to recognize quickly.
And finally, compartment syndrome.
It's all about pain out of proportion to the injury and a tense limb on exam. If you suspect it, a fasciotomy is needed to relieve the pressure and prevent permanent damage.
Let's quickly hit some special population squad. First, for pediatrics.
Key point, hypotension is a late sign in children. They compensate better initially, so tachycardia is an earlier indicator of shock. And remember the Bros Low tape for rapid equipment sizing and drug dosing based on length. It's a game changer.
And our geriatric patients?
They have a blunted physiologic response. They might not show the typical tachycardia with significant blood loss, and they may be on multiple medications like beta blockers or blood thinners. Be liberal with CT scans for head and spine injuries.
And last but not least, pregnancy.
If the pregnant patient is greater than 20 weeks gestation, you need to manually displace the uterus leftward to relieve pressure on the inferior vena cava and improve venous return. Also monitor the fetal heart rate after maternal stabilization. And remember, Rh negative patients need RhD immunoglobulin to prevent isoimmunization.
All right, team, no bogus answers today. Keep studying. We will see you next time here on Surgery Shelf Prep.
Later.